Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Mark Deuze at the University of Amsterdam.
Prof Deuze, thank you so much for being here. And I'm lucky, unlike the listeners, I can see your beautiful home, and you just gave me a guided tour of the canals. Amsterdam, one of the most wonderful cities in the world, in my opinion, almost unique. It is a fabulous place. The only problem is all those bicycles getting in the way of big cars, right?
Well, the big cars are disappearing. I mean, the whole city is basically one big building pit, including the street in front of my house. But and what they're doing is reclaiming the streets for greenery and bikes. So the cars are being pushed out, much to the chagrin of drivers. But yeah, dodging cyclists is a semi-professional art here. It's very true.
What about disabled people who might need some additional help to get around? I presume they're being factored into this.
Well, not as much as should be, I guess, would be the answer to that. I mean, and look, with all the tiny little streets and weird bridges and everything, getting around, for example, on a wheelchair isn't easy to begin with.
Yeah.
So cars out of the picture, that at least gives a little bit more breathing space. But no, I mean, and getting into houses, almost all the houses along the canals, you can only enter them
by
short
stairs. And the road
yeah.
surfaces, apart from the narrowness, their surfaces are not great. I mean, it's similar in much of the area of Madrid where I live. But anyway, Prof, I asked you to do this because I wanted people to get the chance to learn more about you and your work. And I wanted to start in my conventional way by asking if you would share with us what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Well, it's this notion of, you know, whatever you do, do what makes you come alive, right? It's that
Yes.
Thing. And so what makes me come alive now is, it's a bit morbid perhaps, but I've become mildly obsessed, not mildly, with the mental health and well-being of media workers. And the reason for this is that it's twofold. On the one hand, that since about roughly 2017 or so, the number of not scholarly but industry reports and studies on different media professionals, whether they be journalists or creatives in advertising, PR officials, actors in film and television, game developers, suffering from mental health problems directly related to work, has been just exploding. And a second reason that I'm really obsessed with this is that around the same time, I started working on a project at the dean's request in my university about the mental health and well-being of faculty at the university. And going deeper into that material, first of all, realizing that all the experience that were shared with me, I realized, well, that's been my career. And I was rather shocked that I never developed the literacy or discourse that you need to articulate how your work is affecting you and that not all these effects are good. And secondly, I started realizing that I've been interviewing, as you know, Toby, media professionals for about 25 years. And only now I realize that all those interviews were about their well-being.
Wow.
It's just neither they nor I had the vocabulary to articulate that. So I'll give you a very concrete example. The first question I ask in every single interview I've ever done with a media professional is, how do you make it work? Which I now appreciate as a question about how you're doing. Like not just in terms of, are you making money? Are you putting food on the table? Are you creating the stories that you want to create? It's like, are you feeling okay? So it's been a sort of a double shock to experience those two things, those reports and my own work at the university. So with the help of a very dear friend who is a specialist in occupational medicine at the Amsterdam Center, we're now using their research to look back at the data on media production studies to sort of understand and appreciate what about the work in media makes people sick. And that's really all I can think about at the moment.
I can understand that. I've always found journalists to be the most difficult interviewees. And one thing that a lot of them are trained to believe, and you know all about this, is don't make yourself the story.
Right.
And I think that's one of the a key problem for a lot of journalists.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, it's so important that you mentioned that because, you know, look, in journalism studies, in media studies, generally journalism studies, everybody at some point talks about objectivity, right? Objectivity as a strategic ritual, objectivity as something to aspire to, objectivity as the foundation for journalism's privileged position in society. Every journalism student or academic at some point has to do something with this objectivity nonsense. What I've learned in this project is to look at objectivity as a coping mechanism, an emotional coping mechanism to deal with the fact that the job of a journalist, their entire life, is to focus on all the shit that happens to other people's lives. Cover that. As somebody once said, journalists are our sin eaters, right? They eat up all the sins of the world and spit it back out to us as news. But in the process, this does something to them. Psychologists would call this secondary traumatization, right? They're not traumatized by experiencing the war, I mean, being part of the war or being part of the family conflict that led to a suicide or to the traffic accident. But they have to deal with it in a secondary way by reporting on it or by dealing with a colleague that has to report on it. And this does something to journalists. And one of the very few ways they've have to deal with that is detachment. It's literally, so it's detachment, not as a new, as a value for journalists, but as an emotional coping mechanism to deal with trauma.
Now, Prof. D, when you go back over that quarter of a century of talking to people, as well as your own experiences, do you see any changes? So, for example, in the Global North, many media workers have always been precarious, think of most musicians.
Yes.
But many media workers have become more precarious over time, think of journalists. So looking back on that history, do you see a difference in people's well-being that you might attribute or not to questions of precarity?
Yes, I do. And I mean, it's interesting, right? Among the very first applications of precarity to media workers, I mean, precarity studies have been around since Pierre Bourdieu's work in the early 60s. But among the first applications specifically of that notion of precarity, this sort of structural anxiety and uncertainty about, you know, what's going to happen to you, was done by people such as Angela McRobbie and Andrew Ross, who also in their work at the time, which is the part of their work that isn't referenced enough, said the fact that media workers are or are becoming more precarious might lead to new forms of solidarity. Solidarity between, you know, white-collar workers such as media professionals with other workers such as, you know, service and retail employees and cleaners and, you know, that kind of stuff. People have always been precarious. But also solidarity across different media professions. And so to answer your question, what has been different? I think that has been is becoming different, is that media workers are beginning to collectively organize in ways that they didn't do before. I mean, you see it like in the United States, unions starting on the newsroom level, like the LA Times has its own union and Vice when it was still around. And
yes.
the game industry, like professionals banding together, also informally through hashtags. We've got a lot of court cases right now against the toxic workplace practices of Blizzard Activision, with me game developers from different studios banding together online saying, this is not my industry. Obviously, you know, and I think one of the things that have accelerated interest and awareness about health and well-being has been the 2016 Me Too explosion of first tweets and then stories and court cases. So to answer your question, yes, media professionals across all the industries are now shared in their experience of precarity, and they're beginning to share forms of collective organization, sometimes formally joining unions, but a lot of times informally, as in sharing stories and thereby raising awareness. And that together, I think, really explains how the industry is taking note and publishing now all these reports about, hey, there's something rotten in the industry. We need to do something.
And this is my moment to ask you about Skinflower.
Ha-ha! Yes! The most important thing. Because academia is just a side gig, as you know, Toby. It's the real... No, yeah. Skinflower is the band I play in. We've been playing together since 1988. But originally it was just a couple of guys making lots of noise and hoping that we would score groupies. And that never happened. But then I moved abroad for a long time. I lived a couple of years in South Africa, 10 years in the US. As you know, we used to hang out in LA, which is absolutely a wonderful memory. And then when I got back to the Netherlands 10 years ago, we got the band back together and played a couple of gigs, and then realized this is more than just fun. There's an urgency to this. I don't know if it's a midlife crisis. We call it whatever you want. At least we're not trying to find younger girlfriends anymore. What we're trying to do is to really think about what it is that what story do we want to tell and how important that is to us and who we are. So we built our own studio, and at the moment, finishing this weekend, we're finishing recording our very first after the 1988 album. And we're going on tour next year across Europe. A couple of days ago, we got a gig confirmed in the Hard Rock Cafe in Warsaw in Poland, which will be awesome. So, and we're still making noise. And it's a very happy part of my life.
So you're a Cold War band, like ABBA or the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, really?
Yeah, I mean, you'll make our guitarist very happy to reference the Beatles there. I mean, I think the impetus for our band in 1988 was the first album of Nirvana. That was really, I mean, the first Soundgarden album, the first Nirvana album. That was sort of what got us going. And in a way, we're still in that vein. I guess with a 21st century jacket on.
And why not? I mean, I think that's exciting, and I appreciate your sharing with us the very exciting news about the first album and about the tour.
Yep.
And do you guys have some words in Polish that you'll be able to rely on?
Not yet. I mean... And Poland is a funny country in that sense too. I mean, it is.
Well, German would be fine too, right?
Yeah, for sure. But it is interesting that, I mean, there's two. I mean, when we talk about academics and music, two really fascinating things to explore here. On the one hand, is that our kind of music, which is sort of a mixture between metal and punk and grunge, and it's kind of raw, unproduced, angry, but also, you know, with a soft tinge. I mean, that kind of music gets more popular The more you get to societies that where large modern societies where people are suffering. So that's kind of interesting. And a second avenue is I recently found there's a interesting strand in sociology where people study academics who have secret careers as musicians and study how their instrument influences their intellectual endeavors. And so it never occurred to me that the way I play bass might have something to do with what I research or vice versa. And so that's going to be an interesting mirror to look into at some point.
What language or languages do you guys sing in?
It would be English. So we sing in English or sort of a made up language, because often I'm too lazy to write lyrics. So I would sort of like mumble and umming and ahhing along to the melody.
I love it. So that's exciting.
Yes, and it is.
If we may, I'll include in the notes to this recording your Facebook page for the band.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our music is on Bandcamp and YouTube. So, it's very public. And I'm proud of it. I love it. So, yeah.
No, so you should be. Veering back to, in a sense, your day job, and I guess this, I think this is, I don't know if it's the same book, but a book that came out in Dutch and then in English very recently, a very significant book, Life in Media,
yes,
that appeared in English last year and I think in Dutch 5 or 6 years ago, perhaps. Could you tell us a little bit about Life in Media? And I preface this by saying to you, I think the book is great, comma, semicolon. I realize that I'm getting less and less intolerant of absolute media centrism in media studies. I think the book is fantastic, and I actually think it's an antidote to that.
Oh, I would love to hear more about that, obviously, of course. And thanks for mentioning this. I mean, the story is fairly straightforward. I mean, but with a little genealogy here that might be fun to hear. Most of my work is, as we talked about up until now, is about media professionals and how they make it work. And I finished a book called Media Work on that in 2007, which was also the book and publication around that I used for my tenure case. I was working at Indiana University in the US at the time. And as you know, with the American system, a colleague has to sort of comment on your tenure case, sort of write a kind of a faculty statement on. And my colleague who did that was also my mentor at the time, Harmeet Sawhney, a colleague at Indiana University, editor of the Information Society, an absolutely wonderful mentor. And he looked at some of my work and he wrote up a statement and he gave it to me to have a look at. And he said, what do you think? And he ended his statement with saying, well, Marx seems to be arguing that we don't live but in media. I never wrote that. I read that and it's like, that's great. That makes instant sense to me. And I asked him, so where do you get that from? I said, I don't know, but that's just how your work feels. And I contacted my editor at Polity Press at the time. And I said, I want to write a book about living in and not with media. And she said, great. Here's a contract, do it. And a week later, I got the cover for the book. Because she sent that email with the one line, we don't live in with but in media, to their the designer of their covers, and he got inspired and he came up with this idea of fish in a pond with the background of the Matrix code sequence, which was still hip at the time. And so I had a book title, Media Life, and I had an image but nothing else. And that's kind of been at the background of everything up until the publication of Life and Media last year, is to think through the implications of media, not as something that exists outside of us or that happens to us, but media as something that we live in, that we make worlds in. And I know that that intellectually, this is a fairly straightforward assumption underpinning most media studies. But to make that explicit and to make that gel, if you will, with the, for example, lived experiences of students, like how they feel about or experience their media, I found to be a real challenge and a fun challenge. So long story short, so I've been working on this very simple idea that we don't live with but in media since about 2007. And the book, the latest iteration of that work, is a book that basically documents for me how to teach this to, for example, undergraduates or to people who just are getting introduced to media studies, or to that ask themselves the question, what does media studies bring to the global debate about media?
Yeah.
Because that's, I think, a very important agenda for me, is both to sort of think through how to study the media and explain that to students when they live themselves, live in media and don't really see what the big deal is. And secondly, because the whole world is talking about media right now, whether it's AI, whether it's, you know, the infodemic and the pandemic, when it's, you know, misinformation or surveillance, and everybody is talking about media. So what is our story? What makes our disciplinary story particular, and what does it add? And that was very much the purpose of this project.
And I think it's terrific. Apart from anything else, it's very well organized and well written. It is not simplistic, but its prose is simple. And that's obviously meant as a compliment, nothing else.
Mm.
In terms of what I said earlier about not being media-centric, paradoxically, because you say the media have always been important, there is nothing new about this, though the iterations and incarnations may vary over time, you get away from the notion that everything is new, everything is different, and the media now dominate everything. And you do miss having to deal with what is a much more complicated story, because the media have become so varied. Of course, Foucault wrote that universities were a medium, and he was absolutely right. And there are so many different sources of information and pleasure that people use. So I think that is a great strength of the book. Around the same time, you've been responsible for the latest iteration, I think it's the latest, of the esteemed McQuayle's Mass Communication and Media.
Right.
Since, I guess, Dennis passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
A very nice man, I thought, although I met him occasionally at conferences. But whatever state he or I may have been in, he always remembered me and was friendly.
Yeah.
And I think he, again, was somebody who took complex concepts and made them understandable. And it's interesting that there's still mass comm, is still a thought, it's still a syntam, it's still there.
Yeah.
In 2020. So could you tell us a little bit about the genealogy of that book?
Right.
And what it's like taking over a renowned volume and updating it. What was that like?
Oh, Dennis. So again, I have to do a little genealogy here. The I never ever thought about or planned to do a doctorate or become an academic. That was not in my cards. I mean, I'm a first generation university student. I wanted to make music and write about metal bands. That was my ambition in life. I studied journalism so I could interview Slayer. That's, and I did. So work done. I could retire. So I was working as a freelance journalist and interviewing my favorite bands, having a great old time. Of course, like all journalists, not being able to make ends meet, I would do side jobs as secretary in law firms, and you know, just having fun. And I came across an ad in a newspaper. This is the mid-1990s we're talking about. And it said, the University of Amsterdam is looking for people to interview journalists. And I was like, that sounds like fun, right? I mean, I'm a journalist. I like to do interviews. This sounds like a fun gig that will be more fun than being a secretary to a lawyer. So I applied and I got the job. And then I was assigned to work with a professor. And she told me that the deadline of my first chapter. And I was like, what do you mean chapter? She's like, of your dissertation. I said, what is it? I didn't know what a dissertation was. And I didn't know what job I just applied to, which was a PhD position. I didn't know what PhD was. I'm honest here. Like, I had no idea. So she's and I never studied media or mass comm, right? I studied journalism and a little bit of history. So our department at the time had a first year introduction to media mass comm class taught by the good friend Pete Bucker using Dennis McQuill's mass comm theory book. So she said, why don't you go and take that class and read that book? And then we can start talking about your research. And I said, yeah, sure. Because I also, at the time, said theory is an invention of white men in living in ivory towers and it should all be destroyed. So I was so intimidated and scared. But so I started following that course. And midway through the course, Pete got sick. And because I was a beginning PhD student, he said, could you take over a couple of my lectures? And I was like, all right. And we, you know, this University of Amsterdam, 400 kids in the classroom. And here's the McQuill book and go teach it. As you know, the best way to learn anything is to teach it. So I had to read that book and teach it. And it was so much fun. I had a ball and I've been teaching those kind of courses ever since. And so, and Dennis, at the time, when my first year as PhD student was the year he retired from the University of Amsterdam, but he was still around. And we would often chat and have brainstorm sessions about my project. And he loved the fact that I didn't know what a PhD was. And he, as you said, he's just always exceptionally kind and generous with his time and just funny. And just loved him and loved teaching with his book. For me, his book, a lot of people find it very dense, but I can see he's a storyteller. He tells the story of the discipline rather than listing the theories. And as a journalist, I'm a storyteller, as a musician too. So that's, anyways, long story short, about, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, 2010 was the last edition Dennis made. And shortly after that, we attended a conference together and we had coffee in the morning. And he said, Mark, I'm done with the book, right? It's time that this book is retired. And it just physically hurt me. It's like, that just doesn't feel right. And I was just arrogant enough to just approach Sage and say, like, what are your plans with the book? And what can I do to help save it? And they let me know that Dennis left instruction that if anybody else wanted to do it, they had to ask me first. He never told me, which was just, of course, wonderful compliment and great for my ego, but also scary as hell because, you know, it's a very much like I'm not worthy and this is above my pay grade kind of project. But it was always a passion project. Like I felt this book needs to be preserved with his name. And that's where that project came from. And at the moment, I'm supposed to work on a new edition. And I'm still scared shitless about the project. But it was really wonderful to work. And halfway through working on the last edition, Dennis passed away, which added a sense of urgency to it. And it has so much potential, the book. It's still, and thanks to Dennis, one of the few books in our field that really tries to engage both the humanities and the social sciences in their ways of approaching media and mass comm. It's one of the few books that at least tries to have a decolonial debate about mass comm theory. Yes. I mean, look, he's been updating the book since the 60s. We can forgive him for not being all inclusive, but he tried. And I don't see that in any of the, with all due respect, American or British books, any of them. None of them engage African, South American, Asian, Islamic traditions of com theory or mass com theory. So I still feel the book should be preserved, and there will be new editions, but damn, it's a project.
Indeed. And I think you're right. And my problem with the numerous attempts to, supposed attempts to do these things, is that they announce themselves de-Westernizing this, de-Westernizing that.
Mm.
But it doesn't mean anything except what used to be derided by feminists as add women and stir.
Yeah.
As if there were no fundamental challenge to many of the precepts. I wanted to ask you about another one of your books that I think is a landmark, this co-edited book, Making Media.
Mm.
Because one of the other areas that tends to be neglected in the study of the media is exactly where you began our conversation today. And you've done a lot of work on, a lot of research into this, and that is work.
Right.
Especially since so many young people go into studying this, not because they want to be better citizens, mm. but because they want a damn job and they think this would be glamorous or interesting or whatever it might be.
Right. Yeah.
So I wonder if you could take us through that issue in general, but also perhaps most particularly this, again, fairly recent, I think it's 2019, Making Media book, which has a vast array of topics and contributors.
Well, it's like, I would say almost like all my work, most of my work is directly related to my teaching, in a sense that after coming back from the US and starting my professorship here in Amsterdam, and of course, I mean, when you enter the new department and you have a new role, and this time I'm all of a sudden a full professor. Oh my God, what am I supposed to be doing? I have responsibilities. I looked at the curriculum and said, what could I do? And of course, the first thing I asked, like, can I do our introduction course? Because I love doing that. And yeah. And I couldn't. So I taught it in a different institute for 4 years until I could finally do it in our own department. But then there was this other thing. Whenever I teach a first year undergraduate student course, I do a show of hands, like, how many you are here because you want a job in the media? And it's 99%. Everywhere I've been in the world, I do that show of hands, and it's always the same. Every journalism, media, com, mass com department in the planet, exactly as you say, is populated with young people who want to work in film and TV and games and advertising, marketing, PR, you know, the odd journalist. and most of these schools and units don't tell them what that career will be like. Some of them will give them some practical courses, some skills, not many, but especially in the US, you have now and then some production courses. Some of them maybe will tell them a little bit about the political economy of media, something about ownership and power and money and those kind of things. But virtually none tell them what that's going to be like, other than sending them off to do internships. And that makes me feel profoundly uncomfortable. It's like somebody should tell them at least a little bit of what this is going to be like, not to warn them, but to sort of equip them. Yeah. And secondly, it offers a chance to cut across the different professions, because that is something I feel very strongly about. I don't want to talk about journalists. I don't want to talk about game developers or advertising creatives or musicians. I want to talk about media makers. Because the motivations of all these people to do what they do are the same. Mm. The kind of precarity that they face, as we talked about earlier, is similar or the same. The technological and changing environment, the changing behavior of audiences, the political economy of their industry is the same. So they need to learn from each other.
That's the real media convergence.
Exactly. It's so true. It's the convergence that is felt and experienced by the people making media, not so much by the bits and bytes and the cables and the formats. And anyway, so I wanted to come up with a course to teach at the University of Amsterdam that was only about what's it really like to make media professionally. And it took me a couple of years to pitch it and get it approved and get it on the books. And then I needed something to teach it with. And I struggled. I mean, media work and media production studies is something that our field is, thanks mainly to David Hesmanhog as the main, I would say, instigator of this, and you know, Nicholas Garnham, Vicky Meyer. Some people have spearheaded this, but it's often still quite theoretical. Again, David Hesmanhog and Sarah Baker's work is the biggest exception here. Or it's almost completely US and UK centric. And sometimes also very disciplinary specific. So it's either media economics and management, or it's either very sort of cultural studies, or it's either very political economy driven. And with few exceptions, based grounded in the lived experience of professionals. So Making Media the Book was an attempt to sort of come up with a book that I could use for that class. I have mixed feelings about the success of that. I mean, I don't use it in my own class anymore. I use it the first couple of years, not anymore. Also because the field has exploded and there's now so much really great and rich work on, you know, the experience of media professionals that, you know, we can easily put together a really great reader. But Making Media came out of, you know, needing a book to teach a course about what's it really like to make media professionally. What are you experiencing? How do you manage yourself? How do you survive in a firm context or a studio context? What are the big debates across these different industries? And of course, you know, precarity is a powerful theme in all of that.
Yes. And I wanted also to ask you about a book that I must admit I haven't read. I don't have access to it.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, although I actually work in a faculty of information sciences and in the Department of Journalism, we don't have huge resources dedicated to English language publications.
Right.
Beyond Journalism.
Oh, yes.
What's it about, and what is Beyond Journalism?
Well, for me, Beyond Journalism was my farewell to journalism studies. That sounds very dramatic, like that matters to anybody, but it matters to me.
Yeah, that's good enough.
And I wrote it with my very, very, very dear friend, Tamara Witzke. Again, a very brief story. When I moved back to the Netherlands after 10 years in the US, this was 10 years ago, you know, as a new professor, I was making the rounds along most of the journalism companies here in the Netherlands, sort of because I was responsible for an MA program in journalism in Amsterdam. Sort of to introduce myself and to ask, so, hey, what's going on? What do you need? What are the big debates? And one thing that was happening in the Netherlands at the time was there were a couple of startups, like small companies started by individual journalists and working together in small groups that were doing really cool stuff. One was Blendl, which was about micropayments for news. And the other one was Follow the Money, which was sort of an investigative journalism community, pursuing sort of investigative reporting on big business.
Right.
The people involved, some of the people involved, I knew from before. They were former students or people I, you know, befriended along the way. So we would hang out and talk, and there was an energy there that I didn't find in any of the mainstream newsrooms that I visited at that time. And, you know, to come back to what I said earlier, whatever we do, it has to make us come alive. It's like there was something there, something crackling like a fire that was truly exciting. And I said, this, whatever I do, this is what I need to study. And I soon realized this wasn't a Dutch thing, journalists striking out on their own, setting up their own companies. It was happening all over the world. whether it was in Ghana or Nepal or in Colombia or in Denmark or, you know, everywhere, Australia or Hong Kong. It was happening everywhere. And so every year with a group of students, we would do case studies of these particular startups. You know, why would they, would these journalists do this risky thing? What are they hoping to achieve? How did they make it work? What does this kind of work mean to them? And most fundamentally, what is their working definition of journalism?
Yeah.
And similar or different from the what we would call legacy news organizations. And so in other words, what we were asking is, how are these people managing to go beyond journalism? Journalism as this limited definition of the kind of news that is produced by quality legacy mainstream news media, you know, the New York Timeses and the El Paises of this world. And so that's what beyond journalism means, is journalism stripped of its infrastructure, both in terms of the industry, as well as necessarily its value system. I mean, like, if you start your own company in journalism and you build your journalism from the ground up in terms of what you find is important, how does that journalism look like? And look what we found in all these studies. And we've done studies in 25 different countries, over 100 case studies, is that the journalism that all these startups produce isn't necessarily that radically different from what is happening in, you know, in mainstream news organization. It's just the feeling with it's produced is radically different. The kind of commitment, engagement, motivation, rationale, the lived experience of doing the work, it's completely different. And it made us aware how significant it is to include that affective dimension of media work in analyses of journalism, and to appreciate the role that emotion plays in journalism and doing the work. And saying that now, I think, oh, this is all so obvious. But at the time, I didn't have literature to use for that, other than maybe in feminist media studies. And that, looking back in hindsight, the book came out in 2020, opened the doors for me to start looking at affective labor, health, mental health and well-being more explicitly. And that's what I've been doing since.
Now, in terms of places like BuzzFeed and Vox, at the high US-centric, once wealthy end of new institutions of journalism.
Right.
They're fucked now.
Yeah.
Because the big platform post offices no longer direct visitors to them. And that's cut their advertising revenue monumentally. So the fat cat, tech bro playboys, snorting cocaine day and night. And this is not an exaggeration, as you know, this really was going on.
Yeah.
Suddenly have vast amounts of money themselves, but their institutions are gone. What's that meant for these more interesting, more inventive entities? And we've got a few of them here in Spain, of course, as you know. As you say, they're everywhere. Some great
El Diario is a great example,
Now, some of the ones in Colombia, for example, survive because it's not advertising that keeps them going. It's rich foundations in Western Europe and the United States that want to protect journalism in every sense, not just a political economic one, but a life one, right? Yeah. And so they're not under advertising pressure. This is a long-winded way of asking you, because that landscape has really changed in the last 5 or 6 years, what effect has it had on these more interesting, enterprising, less cocaine-driven efforts? Because it's so hard to make money through digital journalism now.
Yeah, and to give you an example of how not cocaine-driven this is, I mean, a memorable experience was the Danish journalist investigative journalism startup Zetland, based out of Copenhagen, And they start every workday in their cute little offices in a hip part of of Copenhagen with singing together. So it's not snorting coke. And look, the story of the Vices and BuzzFeeds of this world is interesting because they forgot to stay the startup that they were, right? They started to become managed to the whim of advertisers and platform metrics and continuing rounds of seed funding, but not actually a solid basis of content to and a healthy work culture, because the culture of work at these places was a nightmare.
Yeah,
I
terrible
mean,
for women, especially, I think.
exactly, harassment, bullying, I mean, all that kind of stuff. So in that sense, to me, that is the real explanation, the horrible mismanagement and trying to, excuse me, trying to be a kind of company that they were not. And it is interesting that a lot of these smaller ventures and these startups in journalism, of course, not many survive, but many keep popping up all over the place. Is exactly because they don't try to act like a mainstream or mass media organization, that their success is not based on distribution or reach, but of engagement and community and membership. And then, of course, there's a second element to this, as you rightfully point out, is the role of foundations. And foundation funding is a tricky animal. I mean, we've just completed a study. The publication thereof came out late last year. It's a study by one of my PhD students, Aaron van het Hof, and he looked at foundations funding journalism work here in the Netherlands. And it used to be one or two, and now there's well over 30 of these foundations, all of a sudden, all funding journalism. And he interviewed all of them, with one exception, who said no. Basically wondering, how do you actually make decisions on what to fund and what not? And how aware are they that the reason why they fund journalism, the precarity of journalists and the inability of investigative journalism to be funded properly, is also maintained by the very fact that they're funding journalism, right? They're paying journalists to do the work that gets published for free in these mainstream news organizations, news media. And and they are aware of that, but they're not quite sure how to deal with that. But the first thing, how do they make their decisions? And what is interesting is that they're all stuck in a very limited way of defining and thinking about journalism. To them is like Watergate, right? The investigative reporting, you know, getting the dark secrets, you know, out and publishing that for all to know, and topple government and stuff like that. And sure, that's wonderful and that's lovely, but there is about a million other ways of telling stories in journalism about other topics, and maybe about topics that aren't about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, but about things that small communities are doing to make their lives just a little bit better. And I find it heartening and hopeful that a lot of smaller journalism companies and communities and collectives survive exactly because that's what they believe in. And Aaron's, my PhD student's project is motivated by a really beautiful sentiment that he came up with. He doesn't ask how do investigative journalists make it work or something like that. Nay. How are journalists able to do the kind of journalism they believe in? So he doesn't privilege any particular kind of journalism. He privileges the motivation and engagement of human beings wanting to become journalists. And if we talk about the future of journalism, that discussion to me is much more interesting than the future of the New York Times.
Prof, I want to ask you two more questions, if I may, and then throw things back to you to add anything you want. My first question is to ask you what you think about this. The problem with the political economy of the media is that all too often, as a content, as a context, it's leftist functionalism. It's about domination by state and capital. And there is no conflict, ironically, given that it has Marxist premises.
Right.
And there's no labor in it. It's yeah. all state and capital. The problem with cultural studies of the media is the opposite. It's all too conflictual without dealing with the reality of structures, political, economic power. Please discuss. What do you think?
Well, you could argue what both of these perspectives miss out on is joy. Or to put it less glibly, the effective dimension of how industries work. I mean, the political economy forgets that most CEOs of media companies are absolute idiots that do things on whims, pump $100 million into ventures because they think it's cool or fun and not based on any kind of business decision. And the cultural studies people often forget something. I mean, they all cite Foucault, but they forget that Foucault himself made a big point of it, that power is always struggle. So they forget the struggle. And the struggle is not just, you know, fighting the man or something like that. It's also, you know, dealing in with a team with people from very different backgrounds and competences and still all passionately believing and creating a beautiful story. And it doesn't matter whether that story is the 17th iteration of FIFA or the 12th Marvel movie. It's still, you know, their little baby. I found that the affective dimension of work, the emotional affective dimension, the love, the joy that people have is a gateway to not deny the contributions of cultural studies and political economy, but to rethink them. To give you a very concrete example, a couple of years ago, Linda Steiner and Kalyani Chada were kind enough to invite me to contribute a chapter to a book they were compiling on precarity in news work. And it was like a very critical book about, you know, how precarity was really, exactly as you said earlier in our conversation, once precarity hit journalism, everybody started taking it seriously, even though most other media professions like music, film, have been precarious all along. And our chapter was titled Making Precarity Productive, in a sense that looking at how journalists actually navigate precarity to their own advantage. And this was not to say that, hey, precarity is fine, don't worry about it, but to focus on, again, we had that old question, how do people actually make it work within the system? And to take from that lessons about how the system needs to change. Like, for example, the work I'm doing now on mental health, I'm not trying to come up with a list of things that the industry needs to implement so that nobody will ever suffer a mental health problem anymore. Because what I'm finding is that the very things, aspects of working in the media that make people sick are also the reasons they got into the media in the first place. It's chaotic and stressful existence. They're constant working against impossible deadlines. The crazy social schedule. You know, everybody has to attend the rap party at the end of the movie and get drunk. I mean, a lot of the things that people love about working in the media are like straight highways to mental health disorders and other kind of problems. So, and the same goes for precarity. So a lot of the things that cause precarity in media work are some of the ways in which that media workers utilize to do the kind of work that they care about.
Yeah.
So it's in that sense, to find whether that's a synthesis or a dialectics of cultural studies and political economy. I mean, I remember when media work came out, Henry Jenkins and I had this debate, and he said, yeah, what you're doing is not relying on either cultural studies or political economy for your work. And I was reminded at the time that I never realized that those were two things. I was an idiot, but a helpful idiot, I guess. But yeah, so the way through that to me is very much the way of affect.
And that brings us round to what actually is my second and final question, Prof, before handing over to you. And that is going back again to where you began today, namely chatting about the well-being of academics.
Right.
You've talked a lot about well-being of media workers, but as you said, you received a decanal request to investigate this question.
Yes.
And I'm interested in what you found out. And I ask this partly in the context of COVID-19 and of precarity, which seem in many cases to have merged in their impact on people, or at least had similar impacts.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, look, everything I'm finding out about health and well-being in the media industry can be copy-pasted onto to the academe, right? I mean, institutes of higher education are rife with people on sort of a chaotic array of temporary contracts. You do the work without ever really knowing whether you're doing the work well or right. It's thankless. Other than recognition of your peers. So that's really hard. I mean, we're facing increasing distrust in the world. That doesn't really help. As media professionals sometimes tell me, you know, I'm not telling it anymore at parties that I work at Meta or at a news organization, because all the grief that I'm getting, and the same with academia. Right. So it's very real. I'm very conscious of that fact. And so what did I find? Well, I found, as most people will do when they start studying this and themselves, is that the majority of people working in academia, as well as the majority of our students, are not well. They're just really not well. I mean, the percentages are alarming of people suffering some kind of mental health problem directly related to the work. And for students, most often than not, this is a combination of isolation and stress and substance abuse. For faculty, it's this sort of existential dread about, you know, for example, being on temporary contract or, you know, tenure lines or promotion or the publish or perish, the bane of student evaluations. This is not the fault of students, but the way evaluations are organized and the status granted to them within the institution, the increasing pressure of documenting everything that you do, as people in other professions will testify to, as well as taking away time from actually dealing with, for example, teaching or research. So, I mean, our friends and colleagues in Germany, Thomas Hanich and others, recently did a survey of media mass comm academics around the world, finding alarming statistics that are the same statistics that I find about professionals in the industry. So it's not well. So, but what I started doing during the course of that decanal project was to switch the focus from the problems to happiness. So I insisted on calling my project Our Happiness. And my question became, what makes people happy at work? So rather than, I mean, I acknowledge that there's a lot of problems and people are not feeling well. And I see what universities are doing. They're appointing more counselors. They're having new debates about how to adequately review and assess people's work and everything. That's lovely. But what nobody seems to be asking is, why are people here in the first place? Like, why are you and I professors and academics? What possibly could motivate us to do what we do? And why are we doing it? And should maybe, could we think of the management of institutes of higher education to be focused on that rather than all kinds of bizarre outcomes like learning goals and those kind of things? And that's been my motivating element. And look, and the funny thing is, when you ask these kind of questions, what you end up with in terms of answers are the kind of answers that people who study popular culture in our field, especially fandom, find about fans. Namely, we are here because we're fans. And what do fans want? They want to be left alone to be passionately engaged with whatever this crazy little thing is that they're doing. And they want to be recognized for doing so. Those are very simple. I mean, if you interview a journalist or a game developer or an ad creative, they'll give you that same answer. I want to do what I care about, and I would like to do that as autonomously as possible. And I want somebody somewhere to now and then give me a high five. It's very simple, but it's remarkable how well both industries and academic institutions are horrible in managing to that. And they do it with all kinds of other things, but they don't take that fundamental motivation seriously. And yeah, that to me is sort of a very simple but an eye-opening premise. And I know it's not necessarily new or revolutionary, but it has made me look differently at my own career and my students and my team. Like, I manage my team differently now. I don't ask them about their new... I mean, sure, it's wonderful if they tell me they have a new publication or a grant. I mean, I take them to dinner. We're going to have a party for sure. But I'll give you a very simple, and not to brag, or I don't mean it that way, but something very simple that I started doing, for example, when I was director of graduate studies in our department, was to start every meeting that we had with all the other team chairs, is to just ask everybody, whether voluntarily, to share a bit of good news. And I said, it can be your baby just said his first word. It can be that, you know, your pasta last night came out exceptionally well. Or it can be you've got a $5 million grant. Good for you. It doesn't matter. Just something that you would like to share that was made a big difference in your life recently, a positive difference. And it just changes things. It makes things different. And it's because it asks people to share what the reason why they're actually there, rather than let's go over the budget numbers again, right? So I could go on way too much about this, but it's really made me rethink the way I do things. And you know, we all do the things that we do to change the world. And if the world is only you, that's good enough.
Thanks, Prof. I think this gets to the heart of what I see as the major change in university life.
Mm-hmm.
In the countries that I've taught in over my career, which is that they are now driven by mistrust.
Yeah. Oh,
they were once driven by trust.
Yeah.
And the notion that everybody, students, caterers, cleaners, faculty, are driven by trying to game the system.
Right.
That they're dishonest, that they're not committed, and that they're not competent. And this is accompanied by a vast increase in the number of administrators engaging in surveillance. So I think the sad thing here is that the drive, the desire for autonomy that you're describing, and a certain sense of fulfillment, has to confront this vast enterprise of surveillance, of critique, of so-called accountability, all predicated on you cannot be trusted.
Right.
So a thing everybody has to get beyond in order to find the pleasure that you so rightly speak of is to deal with not being trusted.
Yeah.
Because when I started, I always felt trusted, and I did for a long time. And I think that's the basis for a very satisfying life and career, feeling trust and being trusting in others.
Yep.
I think that's tremendously important. Prof, I'd like for us to conclude by your adding anything you wish, which could be about something we've already discussed, or it might be something entirely different.
Well, it's something that we talked about before we recorded this, it might be of interest of the people tuning into this beautiful podcast that you're doing, which is the structure of an academic career. And I mean, what you and I share is the opportunity to have worked in different countries and on different continents, and not just, you know, visiting for a while, but actually trying to build something of a patchwork career across different countries and continents and everything. And given the precariousness of academic work, this is something that maybe others are facing as well. And I'm just wondering, I mean, to what extent this has been a benefit, or is, I mean, personally, I think that thinking of your work as possibly occurring anywhere on the planet is a way of making precarity productive, right? The horror of the academic system is that it's universalizing, but it's also the opportunity to surf its waves, right? I mean, because, I mean, one country has a promotion system, another a tenure system, another kind of system, but it's comparable. And then everybody does BA, MAs, and PhDs. And I mean, ranks are called different things in different countries, but it's sort of similar in structure, curricula development. So you can sort of navigate that space quite well and sort of making precarity work for you. On the other hand, I realized that that sentiment comes from a position of privilege, right? I was encouraged to move abroad. I didn't have dependents to think about or to take with me.
I just saw one walk in the room.
Right. Yes, that's my dog. And he can't easily... I mean, my partner lives in Australia, so I can't just move to Australia because he's not even allowed into the country there.
Well, I'm on Wednesday. Chinguri and I are going to the vet. He's going to have a pedicure, manicure, and we're going to apply for an EU pussycat passport.
Ah, yes.
Anyway, sorry.
No, yeah.
I was interrupting, but you mentioned dependence, and in walked a four-legged friend.
Yes. So it's the reason why I wanted to raise this is that I'm interested in your perspective in this is how to navigate this space and how to, because you and I share also a more sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, senior position in academia. I mean, the biggest point for us is not to write a new book, but to help the next generation and to write theirs. How do we advise them? And I'm struggling with that because I'm telling on one of my PhD students, oh, don't worry, you'll be fine. You can work anywhere, right? But then they look at me like, yeah, but my partner is here and I've got kids, I've got a dog, I've got a cat, I've got a... And I realized that for them, the work has means something very differently. And I to be admittedly, I struggle with how best I can be of service in that sense.
Well, if I could answer, you know, I've not had a proper job in inverted commas for 10 years now.
Right.
I thought I had one, but I got removed from it. So I've been worrying about writing the next book in the hope of getting another job. However, to get to the nub of your question about advice to give, I say these things to people. One, meet the bare minimum requirements of the state and the university.
Right.
In terms of what you do. Why not more than the bare minimum? Because they'll change their minds tomorrow.
Yeah.
They'll announce that it is essential that everybody do X, and by the time you finish your PhD, they've forgotten X and they're back to Q.
Right.
Don't trust them. They're not trustworthy. And their supposed verities about academic life are not worth anything. There are two things that are better to trust. One is your professional associations, because at least they're up with what's happening in the areas that interest you. And the other is your own heart.
Right.
Never lose sight of, and this gets to what you were saying earlier, Prof. D, of what mattered to you and why you're here and why you're undertaking this project. That is matters much more than satisfying the temporary dictates of unstable institutional frameworks. And then the other thing I say is, well, there are two other things. One is, this doesn't have to be your last word. You don't have to do everything in your doctorate. You can come back to this another time. And finally, you can find work outside academia that is really enriching. If you're studying the media, if you're studying journalism, there are so many social movements, non-government organizations, third sector entities of different kinds, as well as those for profit, that need skills in research, adaptability, creativity, and profundity. And it's worth connecting with those interests as you move along, because it is only a tiny fraction that'll get an ongoing good job at the University of Amsterdam or Harvard.
Right.
And you can have a fulfilling and rich and still scholarly life outside those institutions. So those were, sort of, for what it's worth, those are my answers.
Beautiful. No, that's yeah. And it's funny, right, that those are also the pieces of advice we would give to the students who want a career in the media.
Even so.
But well, it often comes down to know why you want to do what you want to do.
Yes, I think that's tremendously important. And that way you can get around being mistrusted.
Yep.
And all the sense of horror that that can fill you with, the number of forms you've got to fill in,
right,
or simple, the amount of evaluation that is done of you. I am here because I believe in X and Y.
Yeah, exactly. You can trust yourself. Yeah.
And you can trust many of the people around you.
Yes.
That's the other thing. It's the institutions that don't trust you.
Yeah.
And normally senior administrators who have gotten where they are based on mistrust of the world and its institutionalization and their privilege. Prof. Durza, thank you so much for doing this. It's been wonderful reconnecting with you. And
same there. Thank you so much.
So generously. It's been terrific.
Same here. Thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.